Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 7-passenger MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.
From NPR News, this is a special edition of Foreign Dispatch. I'm Didi Skanke. The conflict in Iraq has focused attention on a branch of Islam known as Shiism. The Shia are a minority among the world's 1.3 billion Muslims, but today they dominate in both Iran and Iraq. In Iraq, the division between Shiites and Sunni Muslims is at the heart of much of that country's violence. However, it's still not clear to many Americans who the Shia are and what they believe. In a 5-part series named after one of the holiest figures in Shiite Islam, NPR's Mike Schuster examines The Partisans of Ali, A History of Shia Faith and Politics.
It's not known precisely how many of the world's 1.3 billion Muslims are Shia. The Shia are a minority, comprising between 10 to 15% of the Muslim population, certainly fewer than 200 million all told. The Shia are concentrated in Iran and in southern Iraq and southern Lebanon, but there are significant Shiite communities in Saudi Arabia and Syria, Afghanistan and Pakistan, and India as well. Although the origins of the Sunni-Shiite split were violent, over the centuries, Shiites and Sunnis have lived peacefully together for long periods of time. That appears to be giving way to a new period of spreading conflict in the Middle East between Shia and Sunni, says Daniel Brumberg of Georgetown University, author of Reinventing Khomeini, The Struggle for Reform in Iran.
There is definitely an emerging struggle between Sunni and Shia to define not only the pattern of local politics, but also the relationship between the Islamic world and the West.
That struggle is most violent and dangerous now in Iraq, but it is a struggle that could spread to many Arab nations in the Middle East and to Iran, which is Persian. One other factor about the Shiites bears mentioning, according to Yitzhak Nakash, author of The Shi'is of Iraq.
Shiites constitute 80% of the native population of the oil-rich Persian Gulf region.
Where there is oil in Iran, Shiites predominate. Where there is oil in Iraq, they do as well. And in the oil-rich areas of eastern Saudi Arabia, the Shiites are concentrated too. The original split between Sunnis and Shia occurred soon after the death of the Prophet Muhammad in the year 632. Augustus Norton is author of Hezbollah, A Short History.
There was a dispute in the community of Muslims in present-day Saudi Arabia over the question of succession. That is to say, who is the rightful successor to the Prophet?
Most of the Prophet Muhammad's followers wanted the community of Muslims to determine who would lead after him. A smaller group thought that someone from his family should take up the Prophet's mantle. They favored Ali, who was married to Muhammad's daughter, Fatima. Gregory Gause is professor of Middle East politics at the University of Vermont.
Shia believed that leadership should stay within the family of the Prophet, and thus they were the partisans of Ali. Sunnis believed that leadership should fall to the person who was deemed by the elite of the community to be best able to lead the community. And it was fundamentally that political division that began the Sunni-Shia split.
The Sunnis prevailed and chose a successor to be the first caliph. Eventually, Ali was chosen as the fourth caliph, but not before violent conflict broke out. Two of the earliest caliphs were murdered. War erupted when Ali became caliph, and he too was killed in fighting in 661 near the town of Kufa, now in present-day Iraq. The violence and war split the small community of Muslims into two branches that would never reunite. The war continued with Ali's son, Hussein, leading the Shia, notes Vali Nasser, author of The Shia Revival.
Ali's second son, Hussein, who is buried in the shrine of Karbala in today's Iraq, rejected the rule of the caliph at the time, stood up to the caliph's very large army on a battlefield, and he and 72 members of his family and companions fought against the very large Arab army of the caliph, all of whom were massacred.
Hussein was decapitated. His body was left on the battlefield at Karbala.
Again, Augustus Norton. The year was 680.
And his head was carried in tribute to the Sunni ruler of the day, who was based in Damascus.
These are the original and still highly emotive episodes of Shia history, stories that Shiite clerics tell and retell down to this day.
Ali,
At the Baratha Mosque in Baghdad, a cleric recites a poem for Ali. "We still love you, Ali, and we will call your name until we die." While in Iran, mourners lament the death of Hussein. "It is the symbolism of Hussein's death that holds so much spiritual power for Shiites," says Vali Nasser.
"An innocent spiritual figure is in many ways martyred by a far more powerful unjust force, becomes the crystallizing force around which a faith takes form and takes inspiration."
The Shia called their leaders Imam, Ali being the first, Hussein the second. They commemorate Hussein's death every year in a public ritual of self-flagellation and mourning known as Ashura. The significance of the imams is one of the fundamental differences that separate the two branches of Islam. The imams have taken on a spiritual significance that no clerics in Sunni Islam enjoy, says Gregory Gauze.
Some of the Sunnis believe that some of the Shia are actually attributing almost divine qualities to the imams. And this is a great sin because it is associating human beings with the divinity. And if there's one thing that's central to Islamic teaching, it's the oneness of God.
This difference is especially powerful when it comes to the story of the 12th imam, the hidden imam. Again, Vali Nasser.
In the 10th century, the 12th Shia imam went into occultation. Shiites believe God took him into hiding and he will come back at the end of time. He is known as the Mahdi or the Messiah. So in many ways, the Shiites, much like Jews or Christians, are looking for the coming of the Messiah.
Those who believe in the hidden imam are known as 12er Shiites. They comprise the majority of Shiites in the world today, notes Ray Takei of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Hidden Iran, Paradox and Power in the Islamic Republic.
The belief in the hidden imam is a core of Shiism, similar to belief in resurrection in Catholicism.
These events occurred in the first 3 centuries after Muhammad's death. Over the next centuries, Islam clashed with the European crusaders, with the Mongol conquerors from Central Asia, and spread further by the Ottoman Turks. By the year 1500, Persia was a seat of Sunni Islamic learning, but all that was about to change with the arrival of Azeri conquerors. They established a dynasty in Persia, modern-day Iran, and made it Shiite, says Gregory Gauze.
That dynasty actually came out of what's now eastern Turkey, and they were a Turkic dynasty, kind of one of the leftovers of the Mongol invasions that had disrupted the Middle East for a couple of centuries. The Safavid dynasty made it its political project to convert Iran into a Shia country.
Now the geography of Shiite Islam was largely established and would prevail into the 20th century. There were periods of conflict and periods of peace, but the split remained and would, in the second half of the 20th century, turn out to be one of the most important factors in the upheavals that have ravaged the Middle East. Again, Ray Takei.
Why has there been such a prolonged and protracted disagreement and tension between these two sects? Well, it has to do with political power.
In the 20th century, that meant a complex political dynamic involving Sunni and Shia, Arabs and Persians, colonizers and colonized, oil, and the involvement of the superpowers. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
For centuries, Shiite Muslims have been considered the downtrodden of the Islamic world. But over the last 100 years, their prospects have changed dramatically. In part 2 of our series, NPR's Mike Schuster traces that change.
At the beginning of the 20th century, the Shiites of Iraq and Lebanon were ruled by Sunni Ottoman sultans. The Shiites of Arabia were under the authority of Sunni tribal leaders. In Shiite Persia, the monarchy and the Shiite clergy coexisted, so long as neither ventured into the other's realm. In Shiism, this has been known as quietism. Shiite clerics, by and large, believed that politics was an imperfect practice, so it was better to look inward, says Vali Nasser, author of The Shia Revival.
They also accepted the legitimacy of the rule of monarchs, so long as they did not violate religious law, so long as they did not harm Shiism, and so long as they helped the preservation of the community. So it was not expected that government would be Islamic in a perfect sense. All that was necessary was for government to protect religion.
That arrangement began to crumble soon after World War I. In Persia, Reza Pahlavi, a military officer, seized power in a coup in 1925 and declared himself Shah. Pahlavi changed the name of the state to Iran and set about creating a secular government, much to the dismay of some of the Shiite clergy. Britain and the Soviet Union seized parts of Iran early in the Second World War and in 1941 forced the Shah to abdicate the throne in Tehran in favor of his son, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, reported at the time by the BBC.
We have seen the closing in on the city of British and Russian troops, the hasty departure of numbers of Germans, women and children included, and the first visit of the new Shah to Parliament. Yesterday morning, half the population of Tehran was waiting at corners and along the broad streets under the impression that the armored cars of the Russians or the motorized columns of the British would come roaring into the town.
The young Shah's reign was also marked with instability. In 1953, political turmoil broke out in Tehran, forcing the Shah to flee the country, events captured in movie newsreels.
Death to the Shah! Statues of the ruler and his father are pelted and desecrated by the fanatic followers of the aged Premier Mohammad Mossadegh. In a brazen act of defiance, the statue of the Shah's father is toppled from its pedestal.
In turn, a CIA-engineered operation ousted the nationalist Mossadegh and returned the Shah to power.
Now crowds shout pro-Shah slogans and carry pictures of the troubled ruler of a troubled nation.
After that, the Shah clamped down, creating a merciless secret police that sought to destroy all efforts to challenge his rule. The one institution that the Shah could not dominate was the mosque, according to Juan Cole, professor of Middle East history at the University of Michigan and author of Sacred Space, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam.
Dissidents gravitated to the religious institution just because the secret police didn't and couldn't control it in the way that they were controlling everything else.
One of those dissidents was Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Khomeini began to challenge the Shah's rule in the 1950s. In 1963, he was briefly arrested and then exiled to southern Iraq. In exile, Khomeini developed his idea of what an Islamic state would be, a Shiite Islamic state, under the control of the clergy, notes Gregory Gause, professor of Middle East politics at the University of Vermont.
Khomeini said, "Only the clerics have the true knowledge of the law, of Islamic law, to allow them to govern the state, to be the leaders, the political leaders of the state." This was an enormous innovation in Shia thought and still widely questioned and not accepted among major Shia religious figures.
Among many Shia clerics in Iraq, Iran, and Lebanon at that time, Khomeini's views represented a challenge to a fundamental tenet of Shiism, the role of the 12th Imam, the hidden Imam, who disappeared in the 9th century and who, according to the faithful, will return when God decides to establish justice on earth. Again, Vali Nasser.
This ran again in the face of the whole logic of Shiism, which believed that kind of authority belonged only to the imams.
In 1978, a popular movement exploded in the streets of Iran's cities, aimed at overthrowing the Shah, reported here by the BBC.
There's been a major battle going on here for the last half hour, very much shooting, and the people are trying to take on the tanks. They're throwing Molotov cocktails from the rooftops, and there's a huge tank just in front of me now going down the road, going through all the fires, and people here are throwing Molotov cocktails at them.
From exile, Ayatollah Khomeini emerged as the revolution's leader, and in early 1979, after the Shah fled the country, Khomeini returned.
This is a man they call the father of the revolution, and this is the moment that millions in Iran have been waiting for. After his long years in exile, the first hesitant steps of Ayatollah Khomeini on Iranian soil.
In the midst of the chaos, Khomeini oversaw the writing of a constitution that gave most of the state's power to the supreme religious leader. Late in 1979, Iranian revolutionary students seized the U.S. embassy in Tehran, making hostages of the diplomats there. And in a referendum, Khomeini's constitution was adopted. Ray Takei is author of Democracy in Iran.
I'm not quite sure if it was understood at that time by the frenzied Iranian populace just coming out of a revolutionary experience where they had managed the remarkable task of displacing what appeared to be a robust monarchy, that they were actually going to saddle themselves with an office whose prerogatives and powers would remain unaccountable.
These events in Iran would have a powerful effect on the wider Islamic world. Yitzhak Nakash is author of The Shi'is of Iraq.
The upheaval generated by the Iranian Islamic Revolution emboldened Shiites in the Middle East and reinforced a trend of activism within Shiism that continues to this day.
Khomeini's revolution had a powerful influence in Lebanon, especially after Israel mounted an invasion in 1982 to eliminate Lebanon as a base for guerrilla attacks of the Palestine Liberation Organization. The Israelis ousted the PLO from Lebanon, but sparked the creation of a new enemy, Hezbollah.
This was initially created by Iran.
Augustus Norton is author of Hezbollah, A Short History.
With the active participation of these young Lebanese clerics, really in many cases simply students in their 20s. And this began really as a sort of cat's paw of Iranian influence in Lebanon.
But Khomeini and his followers did not want his version of Islamic revolution and the Islamic State limited to Shiism. He wanted the Sunni world to embrace it as well. And initially, Khomeini's revolution did attract some Sunni enthusiasts, says Ray Takei.
Certainly for many Sunni activists that were resisting their reactionary governments, it was an indication of what power of faith can do.
But most Sunni Muslims rejected the Iranian revolution as a model for their own societies. Sunni governments reacted aggressively, with Saudi Arabia taking steps to strengthen Sunni fundamentalist movements across the Middle East. Saddam Hussein was most aggressive of all. In 1980, he ordered an invasion of Iran to topple the Persians, as he dismissively called them, and seize the Iranian oil fields. This would deepen further the division in the Muslim world between Sunni and Shiite. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
Coming up, the Iran-Iraq War and the origin of Lebanon's Shiite militia, Hezbollah. You're listening to a special edition of Foreign Dispatch.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. The branch of Islam known as Shiism first became widely known in the U.S. with the Iranian Revolution of 1979. That revolution established the modern world's first Islamic state. But efforts by the revolutionaries to export their movement throughout the Middle East met with resistance from Arab states led by Sunni Muslims, and this spawned unforeseen conflicts. Here's NPR's Mike Schuster with the third part of our series.
1979 was a pivotal year in the Muslim world. The Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, Sunni Muslim fundamentalists seized the Grand Mosque in Mecca, and the Ayatollah Khomeini led a Shiite revolution that swept the Shah of Iran from power and put in place an Islamic republic. Khomeini had more grandiose goals, says Juan Cole, professor of Middle East history at the University of Michigan.
Khomeini did not envisage himself as making a revolution in one country. His ideology of clerical rule, the rejection of the Western colonial heritage, he felt was a universal message.
Khomeini put forward the claim to being the leader of the entire Muslim world.
Vali Nasser is author of The Shia Revival.
Some Sunnis began to resist that notion because regardless of the fact that Khomeini saw himself as an Islamic leader, they saw Khomeini as a Shia leader.
That was the view of Sunni leaders across the Middle East, but it was not necessarily shared by the poor and disenfranchised, dazzled by the popular movement that toppled the Iranian monarch. So to convince the wider Arab public, some Sunni leaders, especially in Saudi Arabia, sought to sharpen the differences between Sunni and Shia, says Vali Nasser.
And you needed to emphasize more hardline, radical Sunni views that tend to be more intolerant of Shias. And a great deal of investment was made. And we had the rise of, for the first time, Sunni fundamentalist groups that were different from the old ones.
That was particularly true with the Arab fighters who went to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan, including Osama bin Laden. They then turned on their sponsors, like the Saudis, but were fiercely anti-Shia as well.
Their objective was not just overthrow of secular governments and establishments of Islamic states, but rather their objective very particularly was anti-Shiism.
The most violent reaction to Iran's Shiite revolution came from Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
What you hear in the background is the air raid sirens of Baghdad. which have become a very common sound to those of us who've been living here for the 2 weeks of the war.
Iraq invaded Iran in 1980 to seize its oil fields and destroy Khomeini's revolution. Iran responded with missile attacks on Baghdad, reported here by AP Radio.
I'm standing on my balcony now at the Mansour Milia Hotel in downtown Baghdad, and I can see the cars hustling across the Tigris River bridges to get off the side of the road and take refuge.
But Saddam did not cast the conflict in sectarian terms, says Reta Kay, author of Hidden Iran, Paradox and Power in the Islamic Republic.
Saddam largely represented himself as the bastion of Arab nationalism resisting Persian hordes.
Despite Iraq's aggression and Saddam's brutal regime, Iraq had no trouble attracting the support of all of the Sunni Muslim leaders in the region. The war ground up hundreds of thousands of soldiers on both sides. It was fought initially in Iran's oil-rich region, reported here by the BBC.
As we approached the Iranian city of Abadan, one of the largest oil refineries in the world, the sky was heavy with oil clouds. The city remains in Iranian hands, but the shelling by the Iraqis is constant.
And it was fought on the other side of the border, southern Iraq, where Iraq's Shiite population was concentrated. Wayne White is a former senior State Department intelligence officer.
Iraqi Shia fought desperately in the trenches against their co-religionists in Iran, and it wasn't because Saddam Hussein was holding a gun to their head. In many cases, it was because they didn't like what they saw across the border.
The Battle of Abadan is far from over. The Iranian troops who are being encircled appear determined to resist. The war appears in balance, with the Iraqis yet to force the Iranians to negotiate.
But the loyalty of the Shiites of Iraq won them scant approval from Saddam, says Augustus Norton, professor of Middle East history at Boston University.
Saddam Hussein was very suspicious of the Shiites and their loyalties. Army units were rotated much more frequently than was militarily wise because he suspected the loyalty of these units that were predominantly Shia Muslim.
Then war broke out in another corner of the Middle East. In 1982, Israel launched an all-out invasion of Lebanon, ostensibly to stop guerrilla attacks from the Palestine Liberation Organization. But the conflict, reported here by the BBC, would have unexpected and profound repercussions for the Sunni-Shia divide and for the security of the United States.
Along the whole coastline, they've been mounting remorseless air, sea, and ground attacks on the PLO positions. For their part, the Palestinians say they've been putting up stiff resistance.
These anti-aircraft guns are being fired off from the Palestinian positions in Palestinian camps on the southern outskirts of Beirut.
To get to Beirut, Israeli troops had to march through and occupy southern Lebanon, whose population was overwhelmingly Shiite. It was this invasion that soon would expand the reach of Iran, says Augustus Norton.
The most important reverberation of the Iranian Revolution was in Lebanon. This revolution provided a context for another organization to emerge, and this was Hezbollah, the Party of God.
Not only did Hezbollah and other Shiite militias target the Israelis, but after President Ronald Reagan sent U.S. troops to Lebanon as part of a peacekeeping force, Lebanese militias attacked the Americans as well. In 1983, suicide car and truck bombs exploded at the U.S. Embassy in Beirut and at the U.S. Marine Barracks, with more than 300 dead all told.
These deeds make so evident the bestial nature of those who would assume power if they could have their way and drive us out of that area.
President Reagan soon reversed himself and pulled U.S. troops out of Lebanon, leaving the divided nation to another 6 years of war. The Iran-Iraq war ground on as well, with Iraq's widespread use of chemical weapons. It finally ended in 1988. Vali Nasser says the war's aftermath brought no rewards for Iraq's Shiites, further deepening the Sunni-Shia divide.
They were still treated as an outsider. This attitude still was the same one that Saddam Hussein had at the moment of his hanging when he referred to all the Shias as Persians.
Peace lasted for just 2 years, and then Saddam Hussein embarked on another ill-fated military adventure, the seizure of Kuwait. After a U.S. military force 500,000 strong ousted Iraq's army from Kuwait, the Shiites had had enough of Saddam Hussein and rose up against him. Saddam put down the rebellion brutally.
No one came to their assistance.
Augustus Norton.
Not neighboring Saudi Arabia, not the United States, which had called for the rebellion. No one came to their assistance except the Islamic Republic of Iran.
The Shias began to understand that doesn't matter how much blood they shed, how much they defend the country, they still are treated as second-class citizens.
In the 1990s, Saddam Hussein systematically set about destroying the senior Shiite clerical hierarchy. At least 10 Ayatollahs and their sons and other relatives were murdered by Iraqi agents. Iraqi and Arab nationalism proved less and less attractive to the Shia of Iraq. They became more religious and more sectarian in their outlook. Then came the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, which would unleash forces of Muslim sectarianism unseen in the Middle East in modern times. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
When the United States invaded Iraq 4 years ago, it didn't set out to deepen the Sunni-Shiite divide in the Muslim world. But that may be one of the most important outcomes of the war. NPR's Mike Schuster has the fourth part of our series.
The United States invasion of Iraq began on March 20th, 2003. NPR reporter Eric Westervelt was with the U.S. Army when it encountered resistance outside of Najaf.
Militiamen firing on U.S. positions here on the outskirts of Najaf.
Okay.
God damn!
Take out a bunker over there?
American leaders told the nation and the world that the Iraqis would view the U.S. as liberators, not occupiers, that the war would be over quickly, and that Iraq would return to peace. Those rosy predictions did not take into account the violent and oftentimes tragic history of Iraq, especially the aspirations of Iraq's often brutalized Shiite majority, says Augustus Norton, professor of Middle East history at Boston University.
When proponents of the 2003 Iraq War would argue that the Shia Muslims of Iraq were predominantly secular in orientation, they either ignorantly or conveniently forgot about this recent history, which has had the effect of pushing the Iraqi Shias away from secularism towards, if you will, higher levels of religious identification and religiosity.
So it should not have been surprising that Iraqi Shiite clerics and Shiite political parties immediately seized the initiative, pressing for quick elections and representative government. Yitzhak Nakash is author of Reaching for Power, The Shia in the Modern Arab World.
For well over a century, Shiite clerics have led movements advocating parliamentary rule and just governance in the Middle East. In post-Ba'ath Iraq, clerics have again taken the lead, in large part because there's hardly any form of secular civil society in the country today that can act as the nucleus of an Iraqi political system.
Until the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, the Shia never governed a modern Arab state. They were in control in Persian Iran, but the Sunnis led most Arab states in the Middle East. The change in Iraq was a shock, says Juan Cole, professor of Middle East history at the University of Michigan.
The Shiites have an Arab Shiite champion, and this is a new thing, that Baghdad has emerged as a center of Arab Shiite power.
That provoked a violent backlash among Sunni Arabs in Iraq.
He's saying that Abdelmajid al-Khoui is...
A car bomb explodes at the Shiite shrine of the Imam Ali in Najaf in 2003, as NPR's Ivan Watson conducted an interview there. The Sunni insurgency first targeted American troops, but soon, with the involvement of al-Qaeda in Iraq, attacked the Shiites as well. The targets, Shiite holy sites, Shiite neighborhoods in Baghdad and elsewhere, and ordinary Shiite civilians, thousands of whom have been abducted and murdered. And then, a year ago, the bombing of the Askariya Shrine, a mosque directly connected to the story of the 12th Shiite Imam, the Messianic Hidden Imam. In 2006, the Shia fought back through militia attacks and murder. Shiite-Sunni violence now predominates in Iraq, notes Wayne White, a former senior intelligence officer for the State Department.
It went virtually off the scale with the attack on the mosque, and essentially a cycle of violence has been generated, initiated by al-Qaeda in Iraq, which deliberately attacked Shia targets with suicide bombings in the expressed hope of provoking just this sort of confrontation, and they succeeded all too well.
The U.S. claimed that Iran was responsible for much of the violence in Iraq. There's no question that the Shiite government in Baghdad has a close relationship with Tehran. But that's far from the whole story, says Vali Nasser, author of The Shia Revival.
It is not Iran that is right now a threat to the political power, to the livelihood, to the sense of security of Iraqi Shias. It's the war with their Sunni countrymen that is the main threat.
At the same time, top Shiite clerics in Iraq worked hard to pursue their own model of government, distinct from the Iranian rule of the mullahs. Iraq's senior cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, although born and raised in Iran, advocated a political future for Iraq that is far different from Iran's, says Augustus Norton.
In my view, Ali Sistani does not see the Islamic Republic model as implemented in Iran as at all appropriate for Iraq. And instead, he understands the role of clerics like himself as being outside of the political system.
Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran created the model of the Islamic Republic, with all power resting in the hands of the clerics. Although this has been the government of Iran for more than a quarter century, there are doubters in Iran, as well as in Iraq, and throughout the Shiite world, says Vali Nasser.
The popularity that Ayatollah Sistani has in many places in the Shia world, including in Iran, really underscores the fact that Khomeini's theory is still facing theological difficulties within Shiism because it runs against the grain of the entire Shia religious development.
Still, not all of Iraq's Shia agree. Street fighting in Najaf in 2004. Twice that year, the Shiite militia known as the Mahdi Army attacked American troops. Ayatollah Sistani mediated an end to that fighting, but since then, this militia spawned neighborhood defense forces as well as anti-Sunni death squads. It catapulted its leader, the young firebrand cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, into a prominent role in the Iraqi government. Some in the U.S. claimed he or other Shiite figures are surrogates for Iran, but Wainwright doesn't see it that way.
I think Iran is a secondary actor right now in Iraq, along with Syria and Saudi Arabia, that the internal dynamic, the viciousness of the fighting on the ground is very much being stoked up by communal problems inside of Iraq itself.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
The call to prayer at the Grand Mosque in Mecca. The escalating sectarian violence in Iraq has become a great concern of the Saudi monarchy, fearful that it may spread to the kingdom's own Shiite minority, which lives near some of the most valuable oil fields in eastern Saudi Arabia. The Saudis and other Sunni leaders became even more uneasy when war broke out last summer between Israel and Hezbollah, the Shiite militia in Lebanon.
For the first time, Arabs break rank in the middle of a fight against Israel.
The Sunnis did not automatically support Hezbollah's actions against Israel, says Vali Nasser, because they feared it represented the strengthening of Shiite power and Iranian influence.
A group of Sunni Arabs, jihadis as well as kings and presidents, adopt a sectarian posture towards Hezbollah.
In response to the chaos, the United States found itself siding overtly with Sunni leaders and nations. Yitzhak Nakash says that does not take into account the full record of Shiite politics in recent years.
The increase in acts of violence by Shiites against Western targets since the mid-1990s has stood in contrast to the growth of Sunni-sponsored terrorism by Al-Qaeda and other militant groups, a strategy that all Shiite groups have condemned, including the Lebanese Hezbollah organization, the Sadr movement in Iraq, and the hardline regime in Iran.
History does not seem to be the preferred guide as the U.S. makes its way through the chaotic upheavals of the Middle East today. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. When the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, President Bush said the aim was to overthrow Saddam Hussein and bring democracy to Iraq and the region. Over the years, those aims have changed. Now the goals are to bring stability to Iraq and prevent the emergence of Shiite Iran as a regional power. In the final part of our series, NPR's Mike Schuster examines the conflicts and contradictions of U.S. policy in the Middle East.
For years, the Bush administration tried to deny one of the obvious outcomes of the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, that with the overthrow of the Taliban and Saddam Hussein, Iran has emerged strengthened and confident. Now administration officials seem obsessed by Iran. Witness comments from Vice President Cheney recently on Fox News.
The threat that Iran represents is growing, it's multidimensional, and it is in fact of concern to everybody in the region.
According to Cheney, those who are concerned, America's friends in the Middle East, are Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and the Gulf states, all governments led by Sunni presidents or kings. Yet at the same time, the United States is backing a Shiite government in Iraq that has close and cordial relations with Iran. It's a policy of contradictions, says Augustus Norton, a historian of the Middle East at Boston University.
The U.S. is building an alliance in the Arab world against Shi'i Iran. And, of course, the key components in this alliance are Cairo, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. At the same time, the U.S. is trying to maintain friendly relations with a majority Shi'i government in Baghdad. I don't think this is a very stable solution.
Ayman Shaheen is far less diplomatic. Shaheen is a Palestinian professor of political science in Gaza.
You worked against the history. Never Shi'at governed in the Arab world. Through 14 centuries, Shi'at will never govern in the Arab world. And this is your fatal mistake. That's why you will pay a big price.
At the same time, the U.S. view of some Shiite forces in the Middle East, specifically in Lebanon and in Iraq as well, is overtly hostile. President Bush made that plain in his recent State of the Union address.
The Shia and Sunni extremists are different faces of the same totalitarian threat. Whatever slogans they chant, when they slaughter the innocent, they have the same wicked purposes. They want to kill Americans, kill democracy in the Middle East, and gain the weapons to kill on an even more horrific scale.
But it's not so simple, says Ray Takei, author of Hidden Iran.
The president has this stark demarcation where you're on one side or the other, yet you see it's much more murky and ambiguous. As the color of truth in the Middle East is gray. It's not white and it's not black.
Roger, go ahead. You should engage.
U.S. military action near the Shiite holy city of Karbala during the invasion of Iraq in 2003. That invasion did set in motion a political process that has fostered majority rule in Iraq. But the Bush administration did not anticipate that goal would aggravate the Sunni-Shia divide. It did, nevertheless, says Daniel Brumberg of Georgetown University.
One of the consequences of our intervention in Iraq was to exacerbate these tensions between Sunni and Shia, beginning in Iraq, but of course then in Lebanon and beyond.
In fact, there seemed to be little awareness in Washington of the potential for such sectarian conflict, says Gregory Gause, professor of Middle East politics at the University of Vermont.
Washington doesn't think in these sectarian terms. The danger is that they might not realize the intensity with which some people in the Middle East do think in these sectarian terms.
That is especially true, says Augustus Norton, now that the Bush administration is focusing its attention on Iran.
To the extent tensions and perhaps even violence increases between the U.S. and Iran, it's likely that we're going to see Shia Muslims in Iraq taking the side not of the Americans, but of their co-religionists in Iran.
That's quite the opposite of the goal that Michael Hayden set out for U.S. policy in Iraq when he testified before a congressional panel recently. Michael Hayden is director of the CIA.
Iraq has to be a barrier to Iranian expansionism, not a bridge for Iranian expansionism.
But the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq removed Iran's two most dangerous neighbors and enemies. Actually, U.S. policy has worked against the containment of Iran, says Augustus Norton.
Oftentimes, the paradox goes unrecognized. But it's stunningly true that Iran has been the great geopolitical victor of American sacrifice and war.
U.S. policy is further complicated by the close relationship between the Bush administration and Israel and lack of progress on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The invasion of Iraq has proved of no benefit to that, says Ray Takei.
I think the dream that the newly elected Iraqi government was going to reconcile with Israel is yet another anticipation that has vanished.
The sectarian divide in the region only deepened when war broke out last summer between Israel and Hezbollah, the Shiite militia in Lebanon. The Bush administration's reluctance to negotiate a quick end to the fighting didn't help, nor did comments made at the time by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice.
I have no interest in diplomacy for the sake of returning Lebanon and Israel to the status quo ante. I think it would be a mistake. What we're seeing here, in a sense, is the birth pangs of a new Middle East. And whatever we do, we have to be certain that we're pushing forward to the new Middle East, not going back to the old one.
Although bloodied, Hezbollah emerged with its military reputation burnished. Shiites in Lebanon celebrated the episode as a victory. And many in the region viewed this, too, as an extension of Iran's influence. There have been some positive developments in the region, but still not anticipated by U.S. policymakers, says Ray Takei.
The new Iran and Iraq are unlikely to go to war against each other, and that's good for Iran, that's good for Iraq, that's good for America.
That removes an often violent rivalry that undermines security in the Persian Gulf for decades. But real security for all in the region seems like a mirage on the desert horizon. Now the United States has little control over what the ultimate outcome will be in Iraq and the wider region, says Daniel Brumberg.
Unfortunately, what we didn't see was the cost in terms of taking decisions which would so undermine the legacy of political stability as to create a desire in some camps, and you see this in Iraq now, for some kind of revival of autocracy that would bring at least a measure of peace and security to everyday Iraqis. It is certainly one of the paradoxes of the American intervention in Iraq.
All it seems, at least in part, because the U.S. paid little or no attention to the history of the region, the troubled history of the split in the Muslim world between Shiite and Sunni. That's the view of Palestinian political scientist Ayman Shaheen.
You worked against the history. You did not recognize the history of the region. So if you want to build a new thing, even your new policy should be based on history. But your policy was based on nothing.
Not a view shared by everyone, certainly, but held by many in the Middle East, who are, after all, the ones that have to live with the results of U.S. actions there. The U.S. is constantly seeking friends in this region, says Juan Cole of the University of Michigan, but ends up creating new enemies.
I think the policy is full of these odd contradictions, and it makes everybody angry at us in the end.
In the Middle East, there is a great awareness of and great sensitivity to the history of the sectarian divide in Islam, among the Shiites and among the Sunnis, just as there is a great awareness of the long and troubled history of the interaction between the Middle East and the West. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that nations that involve themselves in these conflicts, without the benefit of a deep understanding of history, do so at their own peril. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
For more international coverage, listen to your local NPR station, which you can find on npr.org. Or, while there, click on News and World. Dee Dee Skanky, NPR News.